Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Von Sternberg versus Caffey. For the appellants, Von Sternberg is Casey Bridgman, an attorney from Wessington Springs, and for the appellee, Caffey, is Mr. Kent Shelton, an attorney from Huron. Mr. Bridgman, you may proceed, sir. You have 20 minutes.
Thank you. Good morning, Justices.
Morning, Counsel.
This case before the court today presents some interesting issues regarding contract law, regarding how those contracts can be altered. It also involves issues regarding the statute of frauds, issues regarding partnership accounting, issues regarding directed verdicts and damages. I want to deal with some of those issues today, and I want to talk a little bit about the facts of this case before I get into those issues. In this case, Carl Von Sternberg, my client, entered into a contract with Lawrence Caffey December 18th of 1999. This was a management agreement regarding a farm and ranch operation in Buffalo County, South Dakota. The contract encompassed the whole range of duties and obligations, rights and responsibilities between these two parties in regard to that farm and ranch operation in Buffalo County. December of 1999, Carl Von Sternberg paid to Lawrence Caffey $166,765. He prepaid those items to be expended for matters related to this contract. They were for corn that was going to be planted. They were for some feed that was going to be for this cattle. They were for wages for the employee of this cattle operation. In 2000, the parties decided we're going to change this. Instead of Von Sternberg being responsible for the cattle operation, the parties decided to enter into a 50-50 partnership agreement regarding the cattle operation. The 50-50 agreement, because that was a change in the December 18th contract, was incorporated into a new contract. February 26th of 2000, Mr. Von Sternberg and Mr. Caffey entered into a new contractual arrangement. A lot of the things stayed the same regarding that prior agreement on the Buffalo County land and the farm and ranch, but the cattle operation was specifically contractually agreed to be a partnership. All of the items regarding what would be expended regarding this cattle operation were set forth, items for pasture rent, wages, equipment leases, things like that. These parties entered into that contract and went through the ensuing year of 2000 until November 28th of 2000, when they had this settling up meeting, as it was termed at the trial. Some of the contractual provisions that are especially important to our case today are, one, it was a five-year agreement. The agreement was January 1st of 2000. Ending December 31st, 2000, a five-year contract. It could be renewed on a year-to-year basis thereafter if that agreement was in writing, but it was a five-year contract. There was a provision that allowed it to be terminated by either party on 90 days' notice. Other important contractual provisions, the gravel, that's a big issue today. The gravel contractually was agreed by the parties to be handled by Mr. Caffey. He was going to be the agent of Von Sternberg. He could sell the gravel. He could enter into contracts on Von Sternberg's behalf to sell the gravel. He was to use his best efforts to sell the gravel. And the compensation was contractually agreed to be an incentive bonus at Von Sternberg's discretion. And the contract specifically provided that nothing in the contract shall require Von Sternberg to pay an incentive bonus. It was entirely at his discretion.
Is that even a contract?
It is. I mean, you can have a bonus.
But I mean, you didn't have to pay him anything if you didn't feel like it.
That's correct.
You described it. Is that even a contract?
It is a contract. Because, and I believe it is a contract, Your Honor, because there was compensation that could be paid on this. If Caffey did a good job, and they had annual reviews of this contract, if he did a good job, he'd get paid a bonus. And in fact,
paid him a bonus.
And in fact did get paid a $10,000 bonus in this case. In regard to that specific gravel issue, which we believe is probably what the jury awarded, the $25,000 on the counterclaim for the gravel. Now, we're not sure of that, but the gravel sales were $70,000. Mr. Caffey claimed at trial $35,000. Von Sternberg paid him $10,000 at the settling up meeting November 28th of 2000. So the difference, the $25,000, we assume or we guess that the jury awarded to Mr. Caffey on his counterclaim for the gravel. Now, that gravel, Mr. Caffey claims, was changed. The gravel agreement was changed. He said that they later agreed to a compensation of 50% of all gravel sales. And he said that Don Enns, who was Mr. Von Sternberg's agent, he said Mr. Enns told him that he'd get 50% of the gravel sales. Our contention is you cannot change that written agreement with an oral agreement. In regard to the statutory law, 53-8-7 says that you can only change a written agreement. It can only be altered by a new written agreement without new consideration, or by an executed oral agreement and not otherwise. So those are the two options.
What argument did you make to the trial court when they started testifying about this new gravel arrangement?
The plaintiff, we made a motion prior to trial that no evidence regarding this other arrangement should be allowed at trial. The court didn't decide that issue until basically the morning of trial, and then said he was going to see whether he would let that in or not. He did let it in, but it was over our objection again that should not be allowed, that oral testimony of a change to that contract.
Did you cite a specific statute to the trial court?
In the brief to the trial court, we cited the statute of frauds. That was the main statute we were relying on, that this was an agreement regarding real estate, gravel, that was in the land, and our argument was that we cited 53-8-2-3, I believe, regarding real estate, that real estate contracts or contracts regarding an interest therein cannot have to be in writing to be enforceable.
Did you raise 53-8-7 to the trial court at the time you made your objection during the trial?
I don't believe I did, Your Honor. I believe I argued that he could not allow that evidence because it revised the written agreement. But I don't believe I specifically cited 53-8-7. In regard to...
So are you changing your position now before us, or are you saying that both statutes apply?
We're saying, Your Honor, that both statutes apply. The statute of frauds applies because an agreement regarding real estate has to be in writing to be enforceable. Now, there was an agreement in writing. These parties recognize that. One, we say it's a five-year contract. It is a contract that's terms cannot be completed within 1 year. We're saying it has to be in writing. We're also saying that this provision regarding the sale of gravel real estate has to be in writing. So we argued the statute of frauds to the trial court. We're also arguing that it can't be changed because it's not an executed oral amendment. Now, I realize I'm arguing in the alternative, but I think both statutes apply. I don't think you can change a written agreement that has to be in writing to be enforceable under the statute of frauds, but I also don't believe you can amend any written contract in this manner.
Now, the statute of frauds prohibits enforcement of contract regarding real estate, and that's what you're handing. That's the hook that you're hanging on here. But isn't the arrangement, the alleged arrangement, between these two, an agreement as to compensation, you might call it an employment agreement or something like that. I mean, there wasn't an agreement between these two parties to buy and sell gravel. This was an arrangement for compensation should gravel be sold to third parties.
And, Your Honor, we don't agree that it was just an employment contract, and I believe...
It's an agreement to sell an interest in real estate to third. It's an agreement between two parties as to how they'll be compensated if one of them sells to a third party.
That's correct.
Okay.
And our argument, Your Honor, is that that agreement has to be in writing also. That follows that Scher versus Coates case where a person was selling real estate for another person. He wasn't buying the real estate. He was selling the real estate for another person. There was a written contract that he received $1 an acre for his commission compensation. He later said, he sold some other land later and said, I'm supposed to get $2.50 per acre on the sale of this other land because you orally told me that I'd get $2.50 an acre. The Scher versus Coates case, the Supreme Court in that case held that that was not an executed oral agreement. If the broker in that case or the salesperson in that case had been paid the $2.50 an acre on the land, then he would have been entitled to it. The contract would have been executed. It would have been completed. It would have been performed.
But that doesn't stand for the proposition that the first agreement was an agreement regarding real estate. Coates stands for the other statute that you can't modify absent a written agreement or an executed oral agreement.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Just for a minute, let's go back to Justice Gilbertson's question. And why should Caffey support, why should Caffey exert his best efforts to sell all this gravel if any corresponding promise on the part of Van Sternberg is just illusory? In other words, if he can give him a bonus or not give him a bonus. What consideration supports that agreement?
Well, I believe the consideration regarding this entire contract involves the entire consideration. I mean, we're talking about the consideration Caffey was paid for planting crops, the 50% partnership profit he was being entitled to. So the entire contract had consideration. Now, just on the specific gravel issue, the compensation was an incentive bonus. And the consideration was if he did well, he would expect that he would be paid well. And in this case, the facts bear that out, that he sold $70,000 worth of gravel and he was paid well. He was paid $10,000 on that, which represents quite a good percentage commission. And I don't know if I can explain it any further than that he had the right to receive that compensation. If he didn't perform well, he wouldn't receive anything. And I also believe that the annual review was important to this contract, because if Caffey came to the annual review and decided I didn't get paid very well, then he would not continue the contract in the future. And so I do believe that that right or that incentive bonus was the consideration in this case.
Take me through how the transaction for gravel took place. Because when I read your brief, it seems to me that Caffey was more than just an agent. Caffey could virtually sell the gravel. That's all that he had the power to sell the gravel. Or was there some other process where Sternberg had to okay each sale?
No. The contract specifically provided that Mr. Caffey was entirely in control of the gravel sales. In fact, he contacted, I believe it was Fisher Gravel, they came out and did core samples, checked on this, then he entered into the contracts with the state for the sale of this gravel. Mr. Caffey. I'm sorry.
So Caffey really is more than just simply an agent, he's actually acting as the owner, in the sense that he has the power to sell the gravel outright.
That's correct. And the law regarding the agency power to sell real estate, also our law says that has to be in writing. And it was in writing. The contract, the February 28th, 2000 agreement, Exhibit 2, did provide that he had the written authority to sell land on behalf of Mr. Von Sternberg. He entered into all the contracts. Mr. Von Sternberg didn't know anything about that. He gave him full leeway to sell that gravel.
Now, you said that the statute of frauds applies because this gravel is part of the realty, correct?
Yes.
At what point does it cease becoming part of the realty?
The gravel ceases to be realty when it's extracted or severed from the ground. I believe it's the Broadhurst case and the Wheeler case talk about the fact that gravel can be realty and personal property, and it's realty when it's in the ground. And clearly this was gravel in the ground when they entered into this contract.
But isn't it out of the ground before it's sold? And it's a sale that triggers the contractual obligations?
No. The gravel was not out of the ground when it was sold. The core samples were taken, as testified by Mr. Caffey. They were sent into the state, and then the state entered into the contracts and then came out and extracted the gravel. So the gravel wasn't just sitting out there on the ground ready to be sold or anything like that. It had to be extracted.
And then the price is determined when it's weighed, right?
I believe that's correct. I believe they weigh each one of those loads as it's taken out.
Well, isn't that a fixed point where they're selling it as personal property?
I believe so, Your Honor. And I believe if there would have been a contract entered into at that point in time regarding the sale of the gravel, then it would clearly not fall within the statute of frauds. But our facts bring it within the statute of frauds in that it was agreed to sell the gravel while it was still in the real in the ground.
When did the $70,000 change hands?
There were checks admitted into evidence regarding that. I don't remember the exact dates, but it was sometime after February 28th. It was in the summer months. I would say August, September, but I can't verify that exactly, Your Honor.
Before or after the bonus?
It was before the bonus. The $70,000 was, the checks were paid throughout that time period of February 26, 2000, to the settle-up meeting November 28th of 2000. And then the $10,000 bonus was paid after that, after those gravel sales had taken place.
So you're telling me that if Lean Construction out in Rapid City or Sweetman Construction in Sioux Falls has a person that sells gravel for them, that's got to be a contract in writing or else it's unenforceable?
If that gravel company has the gravel in piles and they're selling gravel, then I don't believe it has to be in writing. But if they're contracting to have the person take that gravel, extract it from the ground, and then pile it up, then I believe it does have to be in writing. Because it's a mineral, it's part of the real estate, and has to be in writing. I want to talk a little bit, if I may, about the five-year contract also. Again, our argument is that this contract falls within the statute of frauds because this is a five-year contract. The only argument that Apelli makes in opposition to that is this argument that it could be terminated by either party on 90 days' notice. I think clearly our courts have decided that issue. In regard to the Ryan case, that court assumed that this provision regarding a termination right, a 90-day notice of termination, did not take that contract out of the statute of frauds of being a contract that could not be performed in less than within a year. The Ryan case said that there's a difference between the term of the contract and the performance of the contract, and we can't consider those two terms as synonymous, because if we consider those terms as synonymous, then the statute of frauds doesn't mean anything. You could always take a contract out of the statute of frauds because I can't think of a contract that could not be terminated within a year, because a person might die, the subject matter of the contract might be lost or destroyed, and so there's all kinds of things that can take a contract outside of that 1 year, and that's why the term of the contract, when it says 5 years, that's when it falls within the statute of frauds.
Yeah.
I don't think I have time to go on to another issue, but I wanted to just clarify the Sheriff versus Coates issue regarding an executed oral agreement. Again, if Mr. Von Sternberg had paid the $35,000 to Lawrence Caffey, then that amendment would be valid. It would be, the trial court would have had a right to admit evidence regarding that contract. There would have been no question because the contract would have been completed by payment. As the Sheriff versus Coates case said, since there was not payment, it was not an executed oral agreement. I believe that we cannot allow contracts to be changed at the will and the whim of any person. If that contract is in writing, it must stand for something, and it must not be able to be revised by an oral statement of another person.
Thank you, Mr. Bridgman. Mr. Shelton, you have 20 minutes, sir.
First of all, good morning, and Council. Beautiful fall morning we have here. Hunting season's almost here, and that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about a man that purchased property to go hunting. I love to hunt. He loved to hunt. Now, he made certain things apparently clear to everyone that was involved in this situation, and that was he wanted a place to go hunting. In his testimony, Carl von Sternberg talked about the fact that the main reason he bought this land was to go hunting. Now, there were numerous contracts entered into by these parties. December 18th, they signed one agreement. That was ultimately changed. There is some question on who wanted those changes. But it's also clear from the testimony that was given that Carl von Sternberg made a lot of changes to this contract, not just Lawrence Caffey. And those were oral changes. The plaintiff would like this court to believe that if we make any oral changes, unless they're in writing to this written contract, we can't do that. They're not valid. They're void. That's not true. And in fact, if we did that, then there's a number of things that this court has to disregard as it relates to Carl von Sternberg. The main thing that this court would have to disregard and that the trial court would have had to disregard as well as a jury is that there was $166,765 paid as prepaid expenses. There was some handwriting there about what those were to be applied to, but that changed. That $166,000 of prepaid expenses never showed up in a contract. It talked about what could be paid and who was responsible to pay that, but there were two contracts that were signed by the parties, December 18th, February 26th of 2000, that make no mention of prepaid expenses.
But that's not an issue in this appeal.
Well, Your Honor, it gets to the fact that there were changes in this agreement, and that those changes were made by both Lawrence Caffey and Carl von Sternberg.
But if you elect to abide by something that's unenforceable, that doesn't mean that the next provision that's in contest becomes enforceable just because you didn't enforce the prior term.
And I understand your Justice's opinion on that, but I would submit to the court that because there was numerous changes, oral changes in this contract, and I'm trying to show the history of the changes in this contract, that Carl von Sternberg made a number of those changes, and each one of those changes were oral. After February 26th, there was no new agreement, none whatsoever as far as written was concerned. We can talk about the gravel. Don Enns, obviously an agent for Carl von Sternberg. Mr. Bridgman stated that in his original opening statement. In the depositions that were cited at court, it was stated that Don Enns was an agent for Carl von Sternberg. Now, I know Carl von Sternberg tried to qualify that and say, well, in this case he was, but he not being paid. He was an agent. There was no question about that. I think the jury made that determination. The court made that determination. As the agent, he came in to see Lawrence Caffey regarding numerous things. He came in on a regular basis. The transcript shows that he came in every couple, 3 weeks, talked to Lawrence about where we're at with this farming operation, the cattle operation, and what are we going to do next. They discussed, and Don Enns' testimony shows this, they discussed the gravel sales. He said they discussed it, and there was mention of this 50% that Carl von Sternberg would give to Lawrence Caffey, 50%. Don Enns, as the acting agent, can enter into these agreements, and in fact, most everyone that dealt in this situation believed Don Enns to be an agent for Carl von Sternberg. While he's in there, they have this discussion about the 50%. When Don Enns leaves, Lawrence Caffey immediately goes to his bookkeeper, Tim Holsworth, and says, we're going to get 50% of the sales on this contract or on this gravel sales. I would submit that this was not a relationship that required a writing. I would submit this was an employment contract that didn't have to be in writing to change. There needed to be a clarification of how much Lawrence Caffey was going to get paid.
Well, all right, but even if you get by 5382, then how do you get by 5387?
Because through the conduct of the parties, this was an orally executed contract. And even though only $10,000 was eventually paid, Lawrence believed he was going to get half of whatever he sold. So through his conduct, and I believe this is what the trial court said too, through the conduct of the parties, and obviously the credibility of the witnesses that the jury decided, they determined, or the court determined, that he made an extreme effort to go out and sell gravel. There was testimony that he sold it from North Dakota to the southern borders of South Dakota, and that there was at least 9 gravel pits in between there that could have sold this gravel. Why would he have gone out and done that, not knowing what, if anything, he was going to receive? Now, it would be easy to say that, well, he only paid him $10,000, therefore that's all he's entitled to. But we know there's a lot of contracts that are verbally between people, and if every time someone could say, yeah, I'll give you 50%, I'll give you this, and then backs up and only gives them a certain amount.
Now, I know you believe that the oral contract wipes out the previous written one. I'll raise the same question to you I raised to other counsels, that first one, even a contract where there's no requirement of any payment for the gravel sales. It's at the discretion of the owner, right?
Well, I would agree with that, but there wasn't a clarification. And in order to, for Mr. Caffey to understand what the agreement was, he wanted a clarification of what he was going to get paid. Because why would he put forth the effort that it required for him to sell that amount of gravel if
that's
he didn't know what he was going to get paid?
That's why I asked if it was even a contract.
I'm sorry, I didn't.
That's why I asked if it was even a contract.
Right. And I agree that there wasn't anything there, and the trial court said there needed to be a clarification of what, if anything, he was going to get paid. And this meeting between Don Enns and Lawrence Caffey determined that. And then the conduct of the parties shows that Lawrence really believed that he was going to receive that amount, because he immediately went to his bookkeeper and said, let's keep track of this because we're going to get 50% of whatever I sell. Now, Don Enns also stated that he did go to Carl von Sternberg and advise him that Caffey was interested in 50%, but then says, I don't know what happened after that.
Doesn't all that go to existence of a contract, not enforceability?
Well, I would agree to a certain extent with Your Honor, but once the parties entered into this, if we can't enforce these contracts, then how are people going to know what they get paid? And then at the end, the person who says, I'm going to pay, but it's up to me how I'm going to pay, then they could do whatever they want every single time, and the person who was to get paid wouldn't have any idea what they're going to receive for the work that they've done. And that's why we needed a clarification of this. Your Honors, there are numerous other issues that Mr. Bridgman was not able to get to, but one of the big issues in this matter is this final accounting. It wasn't a final accounting. The court determined it wasn't a final accounting. This was an ambush at best. On November 27th of 2000, the bookkeeper was called and told that on the very next day, they'd be up there to do their annual review. Not that we're going to do an end-all, we're going to finish it right here, but that we're going to do an annual review. The bookkeeper, Tim Holsworth, for Lawrence Caffey, testified that he would in no way turn this into the IRS as a final accounting, because he wasn't able to put together all the information. Not all the expenses had gone in at that point in time. In fact, there were numerous expenses that came in afterwards. So how could this be a final accounting? The plaintiff would like this court to believe that this was settled as of November 28, 2000. There were checks passed back and forth, there's no doubt about that. But during the testimony at trial, and this goes to the conduct of the parties, the credibility of the witnesses again, there was testimony by Lawrence Caffey and Tim Holsworth, and even by Don Enns and Carl von Sternberg, that Lawrence Caffey was not happy with this situation. Yes, he wrote checks to Carl, he wrote checks to FSA, he did those things, but again, at the request and demand of Carl von Sternberg. The plaintiff would like you to believe that Lawrence was in charge of this whole farming operation, and that Carl von Sternberg was this innocent third party sitting out there and kind of letting Lawrence do everything. Yet he dictated between himself and Don Enns how this farming operation would take place. And one of those things he dictated was, strip the corn, we want to hunt it. We're not going to fence 2 quarters of land, but we want that corn to hunt, and we'll give you 50% of the sales. He was dictating all the way along what should happen in this. Carl von Sternberg is not some person off the street that doesn't know business. He owns numerous businesses out on the East Coast, and he's a savvy businessman. He knew what he was doing, and he was requiring and demanding that Lawrence Caffey do it his way. The next thing that he demanded was the sale of these cows. He demanded that the cows be sold. Lawrence Caffey testified to that. Lawrence Caffey is a farmer. He's a rancher first and a farmer. And he does own a car dealership. He knows, Tim Holsworth testified that he knew, that you don't sell cows in the fall that are bred. You sell them in the spring. You do not sell them in the fall. Why? Because bred cows bring more money in the spring right before calving than they do in the fall. Now, the plaintiff would like this court to believe that this was all up to Lawrence and he made all the decision. It was his decision to sell the cows in the fall. Lawrence would not do that. He testified he would not do that. Tim Holsworth wouldn't advise him to do that. And so the court, based upon the credibility of the witness, the conduct of the parties, determined that this is something that should go to the jury. But in the plaintiff's argument and in the jury award, we find that out of the $51,490.86 that was awarded to the plaintiff, if you subtract away, and if the jury had given anything towards this cow computation and the lost profit that of $46,000, it would have been substantially less than what they did award. So it's our position, the jury didn't even award anything on the cow computation. We didn't win on that. That's not an issue for this court.
How do we know that? I mean, we're doing the same, you're doing the same thing he's doing.
Okay.
And that is assuming.
And I agree with you on that. And therefore, what I would say in response to that, then how do we assume that the $25,000 was for the gravel?
But don't, if we see an error in one of the damages allowed to be given by the jury, are we then bound to send it back so that that can be redone?
Well, I think the court can do that. I think the court can base its decision, and especially with the gravel sales, that this was a modified or a clarification of the agreement, and I don't think the court is bound then to send it back, obviously. But you're right, as far as what you're stating. How can we make that assumption that the $46,000 or whatever wasn't subtracted by the jury and make that decision? But how then can the plaintiff make the decision that the $25,000 came from the gravel sales? Now, it's $25,000, that's what we were asked for, but we were asking for a lot more than that also. We don't have a special verdict form in this case, and maybe that would have been the right thing to do to determine exactly how the jury came up with this award. But we don't have that, Your Honor.
So you're saying that because it's a general verdict, that and since we don't know whether the jury used the incorrect, if it is incorrect, measure of damages, we ought to affirm it for that reason.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons the court could affirm it. And in addition, Your Honor, I believe with the argument that I'm making here today and that I've made in my brief, that would be reasons to affirm it also, Your Honor. This, and I'll say this again, and I'll probably say it one more time before I'm done, this case is based upon the facts. And it's based upon the credibility of the witnesses and the conduct of the parties. And there are numerous things that happened within this case, Your Honor, that the jury needed to decide. And they did decide. They were basically given the whole case. There wasn't much taken out of their hands as far as how to decide this. In other words, Judge Erickson made the decision, you know, there is too much here and too many questions of fact, and he said type things, that I need to give it to the jury and let them decide because it is a factual-based case. So he allowed them it to go to the jury. And that's where we get to the summary judgment motion by the plaintiff on the $80,660.45. The judge specifically stated at the pretrial conference and at the motions, there's just not enough information. He didn't have the transcripts from the depositions. He hadn't heard all the testimony. Not all the witnesses that were going to testify had been deposed, and he couldn't make that decision. But I'd submit to this court that he ultimately did make that decision, and he granted a directed verdict for the plaintiff for the amount that they were requesting, $80,660.45, but said there is question of other expenses that came in after this review meeting. And if you look at the court's decision, he talks specifically about the review meeting, not a final accounting. And he said, we have to take into consideration or allow the jury to take into consideration any expenses, if any, that came in afterwards. And there were numerous expenses that came in afterwards that the parties did not know about as of November 28th because the defendant did not have enough time to prepare a true final accounting. We have the spray of the wheat in the spring and the fall. We have the cost to go back and forth to the fields because it had to be harvested on the basis on the demands of Carl von Sternberg so that they can hunt it. We have the recalculation of the Heiferette project because my client's position is that they shouldn't have had to pay for the tractor. He had his own equipment. Don Enns testified that they were impressed with what Lawrence had as equipment. There was no reason for him to have a tractor. There was no reason for a truck to be used at the farm, another expense that needed to be taken into consideration because he owned a trucking business and he sold Chevy trucks and Ford trucks. He didn't need a truck. And then Marlon Jacoby did very little, if anything, as far as the cow operation and the farming operation because Lawrence did that all. He was out there every couple days and he took care of the whole operation. So it wasn't necessary to have those expenses. And in addition, other expenses came in afterwards. So the Judge Erickson allowed it to go to the jury because of the credibility of the witness and the conduct of the parties. I would leave this court with two things in this matter, and that is that I believe it really comes down to a matter of facts. I believe that it is a he said type situation. I believe that there were numerous changes to this agreement by both sides orally that changed this contract. And we can't allow the plaintiff to say, I'm going to change certain things orally, but you can't do that. That's not fair, Your Honor. That's not equitable. And I believe that the judge's decision regarding this matter should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Bridgman, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Mr. Shelton says that there's been things that are changed constantly. There weren't things that were changed constantly in this contract. The $166,765, there was nothing changed in regard to that. That was a prepaid expense. The only thing that was changed is originally that was paid to be interpreted under the expenses of the December 18th, 99 contract. And then when they entered into the February 26, 2000 contract, the expenses were to be paid according to that second contract. There was no change in regard to that $166,000. The two other items that Mr. Shelton cited regarding the changes were that Carl von Sternberg told Kathy when to sell these cattle. Mr. Von Sternberg was living out east. He came back here to hunt. He entered into this contract so he'd have somebody that knew something about cattle that made these decisions. That's why he put Lawrence Caffey as the managing partner. That's why he spelled out all the duties. Mr. Caffey's a savvy businessman, too. He owns a car dealership and several businesses in Washington Springs. He's been involved with farm and cattle operations all his life, managing these for several people. Don Enns and Von Sternberg did not come in and force this man to sell those cattle. The cattle were sold during a period of time from August to November of 2000. Did Caffey ever complain that they were sold during that time? Did he ever complain at the November 28th, 2000 settling up meeting that you forced me to sell the cattle? We never heard any of that till this lawsuit comes about.
But isn't that something you should have argued to the jury? I assume you did. Why would we be reexamining it now?
Because those facts should not even have been allowed to go to the jury. We did argue those very things to the jury. And the jury must have believed Caffey instead of my clients. So that's a factual matter. But I'm saying those facts should not even have been submitted to a jury. The contract said that Mr. Caffey, as a managing partner, is responsible for selling the cattle. That contract cannot be changed by oral argument. Again, it falls into the statute of frauds, the amendment to contract, unless you have a new written agreement. So absolutely, we argued those to the jury, but it's just like the 50% gravel, the claim that Von Sternberg was ordering him when to sell the cattle. Those were all matters that the trial court should have excluded the evidence because they were violative of the statute of frauds and 53-8-7 regarding amendment to contracts. And that's the very purpose. I mean, Mr. Shelton says that these were contracts, that there was all kinds of oral stuff going back and forth. Well, that's why we have a written contract, so we have something to stand on. That's the reason for the statute of frauds and perjuries, to prohibit this type of evidence from coming in, because anybody can claim anything after that. And if anybody can claim anything, then the statute of frauds doesn't have meaning to keep it to what must be in writing.
But in a way, you know, it almost seems like the statute of frauds is once again being used to promote a fraud upon Caffey, in the sense that if a bonus is discretionary but yet not yet to be not agreed upon or any agreement reached, and then Enns comes in as the agent of Von Sternberg and promises 50% of the total revenue, and Caffey goes out and puts out his best efforts and sells gravel all over the state, you're actually using the statute of frauds to cover up a fraud, because the fraud got them to go out and put forth his best efforts, which he might not have done if he hadn't been promised 50%. So what do you have to say about that?
Okay, first, factually, we disagree. Don Enns testified that he never told Lawrence that he'd get 50%. Von Sternberg testified that he never heard that we were supposed to give Caffey 50%. So there's a factual dispute about it, first of all. It's not that this was something that is guaranteed to have happened.
Which,
now, we're trying to get out.
Argument, the jury resolved in favor of Caffey.
Correct. Okay, so assuming the jury resolved that in favor of Caffey, again, our argument is it should not have come in. Your question, are we perpetrating a fraud by using the statute of frauds? And I'm saying that's exactly what this is for. If Caffey was to get 50%, just like they changed the agreement on the cattle sales from Von Sternberg having all the cattle and all the responsibilities to a 50-50 partnership, Caffey should have come in, they should have amended this agreement with a written agreement. That's how we protect everyone, and that's how we protect the rights of contracts. But if everybody's able to claim oral agreement, oral agreement, oral agreement, then our written agreements don't mean anything. So we don't believe that Von Sternberg is using the statute of frauds to get out of something. We're saying that if that was something they had agreed upon, law says it has to be in writing.
Right. Even if the jury believed that von Sternberg was performing a fraud by doing it.
That's correct.
I understand your argument.
Okay. And we say that because the jury should never have even been allowed to hear that evidence. The court should have excluded any evidence of those oral agreements or alleged oral agreements.
So you would have us do what? Send the whole thing back for a complete new trial?
That's the only thing I think we can do. I think that this court could disallow the counterclaim, and I wanted to deal with that a little bit. The counterclaim of Caffey's talks about gravel sales. The counterclaim doesn't talk about lost profits and things like that. The jury awarded $25,000 on the counterclaim. That's why I believe we can specifically say that was the counterclaim award, the gravel. Whereas the other items, the judge allowed in this accounting to be reduced from the $166,765 that there was a directed verdict that was owed, but was allowed to reduce that. And again, the directed verdict, the directed verdict really wasn't a directed verdict. I mean, under the Thunesen case, what the trial court should have done is award $80,660.45 to von Sternberg and then allow a set-off if Caffey could prove any of his claims. Again, many of which we don't think he should have been able to brought to the jury because of the statute of frauds and the statute regarding amendments to written agreements. But the court said he's entitled to this, if any. I mean, he basically took it away by saying you may not be entitled to anything. And the correct way would have been to award the $80,000 and then to allow set-offs against it. The accounting, we haven't dealt much with the accounting, but the problem we have is this trial was continued twice, and the second time it was specifically continued to give Mr. Caffey time to prepare an accounting. He was specifically ordered to prepare a partnership accounting and to provide deposits, receipts, checks, anything to prove up that accounting. This accounting had nothing to do with accounting. He came in and claimed that he could have sold the cattle 60 to 90 days later and gotten a profit on that. That doesn't have anything to do with accounting methods. That doesn't have anything to do with an accounting. Again, I think the court should have ordered an independent accountant to come in and account for this partnership.
But you could have done the same thing. You could have gotten your own accountant and had that accountant testify to the jury.
The managing partner, Caffey, was in control of all the books. Von Sternberg didn't have any of the books. Everything that was...
I mean, you could have discovered it. You could have gotten the books and given them to an accountant to give you an opinion.
Yeah. Yes, we could have.
I don't understand what's wrong with a partner saying 3 years later, look, the settlement we did at the time was ad hoc, and now I've looked at this over, and now I think there's some further money I'm entitled to. What's wrong with that?
I think, that our laws provide that he can have an accounting, that it can be done, and that it should be done before an action between the parties. But I believe when Mr. Caffey comes in and claims things like gravel, speculative loss on cattle profits, items that are not even related to the partnership, that's when we have a problem with this type of accounting.
Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court will be in recess for approximately 10 minutes.